And welcome to the Peer Project. My name is Chris Duke, and today I am, well, you can see I'm broadcasting from my kitchen table. My usual studio upstairs, slash bedroom, is occupied at the moment, but sometimes a change of scenery brings some fresh energy, doesn't it? So, for some reason this week, we have entered into a strange, exciting new chapter here at the Peer Project, accidentally as well. Over the past week, we've welcomed a wave of new listeners, and I couldn't be happier to have you all join us. And what perfect timing as well, because today I have a guest who literally has been 2 years in the making. Alex Horn, the creator and little assistant of Taskmaster. Now let me share how this came about, because 2 years ago, as a new podcaster and a massive Taskmaster fan, I reached out to Alex, hoping to send him a copy of my book and maybe try and convince him to come on the show. Now, Alex is a very, very, very busy man, but he always replied with kindness as well. And then a few weeks ago, he suggested that we do the interview in person while he was in Edinburgh with the Horn Section. I jumped at the chance, of course I did. Now, in the conversation, we talk about topics like perseverance, chasing your dreams, and never giving up. Even when that big break seems elusive, it's a theme quite close to my heart, which you'll hear me talk about in the podcast as well. And I think you'll find it both inspiring and hopefully relatable as well. If you enjoy the podcast and you want to support what I'm doing, then consider becoming an executive producer. To do this, all you have to do is visit producers.thepeerproject.co.uk and sign up for a monthly donation. Now, this could be anything at all. Any amount helps. Whether it's £5, whether it's £5,000, you know, if you're feeling especially generous or you've got more money than sense, okay, Alex? In return, you'll receive some great perks. Full uncut interviews, live watch-alongs of every interview as they happen, exclusive episodes, and the chance to choose a topic for the new hyper-focus episodes, which are coming soon. I'll be adding more perks as we grow as well. Podcasting, unfortunately, isn't free, and your support makes a massive difference. Before I start the interview with Alex, I want to give a shout out to another podcast that I think you'll love. It's called The Story Pilgrim by Darren Hill. Now, Darren's an actor, he's a storyteller, a part-time cabin crew member for a major airline, and back in 2017, he walked all 500 miles. No, he's not the Proclaimers. Of the Camino de Santiago in 35 days, can you believe that? Performing a one-man play along the way. Now, this is an incredible journey, and the people that he met became the heartbeat of his podcast. In The Story Pilgrim, Darren shares meaningful stories from around the world, inviting our listeners to reflect on life's deeper themes and resilience, connection, and personal growth. Every episode feels like a window into the human experience, and if you're into authentic storytelling and thoughtful reflection, I really recommend giving this a listen. Alright, without further ado, I've been talking long enough, let's jump into the conversation with the one and only Alex Horn. Enjoy.
Is it? How is it?
Yeah, good.
Yeah, that feels good.
Excellent. Right, so I wasn't sure whether I was going to start with this or end with this. But I'm a member of a Facebook group. I don't know if you're aware of this Facebook group. It's called Taskmaster Alex Posting. Have you heard about it?
No. I'm off Facebook.
Okay.
And I'm weaning myself off Twitter. So tell me about Facebook group.
So it's a Taskmaster fan group. There's right. You know, tens of thousands of us in there. It's and it seems to be the only real fan group of Taskmaster fans there. A few weeks ago, I put a post up saying that I was interviewing you. And we had, like, I think I've said this to you as well, like, Taskmaster has helped a lot of people through certain things, and I'm sure you've heard that as well. So I asked everybody in the group if they wanted to send a message to you.
Oh, right.
And this is yours.
Oh, wow.
A gift.
Oh, my word.
Loads of different stories from different people about how you, Taskmaster, your creation has helped them.
I mean,
through different things.
Well, thank you.
The reason that I wanted to do that first is because how does that kind of make you feel in terms of responsibility in terms of something that you've created has helped, changed, and potentially saved people's lives.
Well, it definitely feels very weird and obviously nice. I actually was on my way back from meeting someone this morning, and I bumped into somebody on the street who said a similar thing. So it's not, it happens almost regularly that people say that, but it's so odd because it's completely accidental. I can't really take any credit for it because the idea of the show was just to have a laugh with my friend.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that this had good come of it is lovely. It's so lovely, but I feel slightly awkward because it really, we're always trying to do a good thing. We want it to be positive and make people happy, but the idea that it's helped people, and it's often people with various mental health problems or neurodiversity who didn't feel like they were being listened to or whatever. And it's, I'm just hugely relieved. It didn't go the other way. And I'm really grateful for something like this. It is wonderful. But I definitely feel slightly at a loss for words because it is not, there's people who actually go out of their way to help people. And I don't feel I've done that. So I feel it's slightly undeserved. But it's definitely appreciated.
Is it any pressure? Is there pressure on you in that sense, like having that kind of responsibility for somebody's health that you don't even know?
Not until you just said
that. Oh, okay.
Yeah. No, I don't think so. The thing is, with Taskmaster, it is a proper team, and which sounds like a cop-out, but that the two people who were in charge of it with me, the two Andy, Andy Devonshire and Andy Cartwright, who are the director and the producer, they are so caring, and anytime there's a decision to be made on screen about whether we go one way, which might be funnier, or this way, which might be more caring. I mean, we try to always make it funny, but if there's any risk of isolating someone, we'll always not go down that route. So it's not all on my shoulders, I suppose, is what I'm saying. And there's a whole other team, you know, who put the show together. Yeah. So I don't think I feel too much pressure. And you sort of hope that you're going to do the right thing in the line.
I mean, I think you're been 18 series in. I think you're doing... You're doing all right, eh?
Yeah, I guess you do worry that you might put a foot wrong, you know, a flippant comment or just get the tone wrong. But I think also people are quite... Yeah, you're right. Once you're 18 series in, hopefully people can forgive a misstep.
So where did it come from then? You said it was an idea about like just having a laugh with your friends. Like how did it start and how did it build to, well, where we are now?
Yes. I'm going to tell this over because otherwise I'll read it.
Course,
and then I'll get all sort of weirdly emotional or something. So, it was up here. We're in Edinburgh at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it wasn't up here. My friend Tim Key was up here. I was at home with our firstborn son. And it's quite a sort of stressful time, but really exciting, but also quite boring when you've got a baby. So, he was up here doing the Edinburgh Festival in 2009. And I was at home, jealous of the fact that he was here.
Sure.
So, I don't know. I came up with this idea of setting challenges to 20 comedians. Over the next year, I thought I'd be at home a lot. So I'll send them once a month. I'll send them a task, effectively. And then the following Edinburgh, we came up here 2010, and I had a room over in the Pleasance Dome area, this university building, where at midnight I explained what happened over the year. It took 2 or 3 hours, and it was really fun. And that was that. And then we thought, oh, it was really fun. We should do it again next year, but with 10 people, because 20 was a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And that time round, a production company called Avalon said, oh, you should pitch that as a TV idea. And it took years after that for it to become a TV program, but it was never the plan anyway. So it took a lot of honing and people like Andy coming on board and people like Greg coming on board. So, yeah, it was an accident.
It was an accident, a very happy accident, no way.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of those things you look back and think, God, imagine if I didn't do that. I wonder what I'd be doing now. And I'd probably be doing almost the same thing with the band, but, things would be slightly different.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to talk all about the show, but obviously that's a big part of your life and a big part of your career.
Mm.
Over 18 series, has anybody stood out? Like, and I know it's a really difficult question, probably a really standard question as well, but has anybody really stood out as one, like maybe surprised you in terms of how well they did, but also maybe the opposite way surprised you how badly they did? You know, like a Frank Skinner or something. Was it Frank Skinner that did really badly?
No, he was very close. The first
Bedil
was bad, yeah. Bedil was bad. No, in the first series, they all did well, except for Roshan.
Yes, of course.
And that wasn't a surprise. So we've had, in those 18 series, we've had 90 comedians. So, in a way, I really mean this, they've all been great.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're quite keen on making the casting right. So we really think about it, the mix and all that. And we won't have someone on the show that we don't like and trust and find funny. But there definitely are some out of that 90 who stand out. You know, if I just let your mind go blank, and whoever will swim into vision. I mean, often it's either the very early ones or the most recent ones. I'd definitely say someone like Fern Brady had made an impact. Like, she felt like she was thinking in a different way. And actually, I didn't know her neurodivergent story until I read her book and was, again, hugely relieved that she talked about Taskmaster in a positive way. And I hadn't crossed my mind that people are thinking the way she thinks on the show. So, yeah, she was so funny and so honest. And I'm, very glad that she enjoyed it. But, equally, someone like Lisa Tarbuck thought in a completely different way to anybody else and surprised me. I don't know. I just found her very funny, as I just found Fern very funny. So I guess it's people like that who will answer the question or do the thing in a way that I hadn't expected. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm always looking for. I want to be excited by their response to the instruction.
When somebody finds a loophole, like a loophole that you're not expecting, does it ever annoy you? Do you ever go, oh, God, I wish I'd covered myself for that one?
No, I love a loophole. I don't feel like it's me against them. I feel like it's them against each other. And I love it. The worry is, so the way it works, they come to the house one by one to do these things in isolation. So if the first person opens a task and finds a loophole, straight away I think, oh no, this could not, if they all do that, it won't work.
Mm-hmm.
But they invariably don't. They invariably do it in different ways. So no, I never mind, you know, I might pretend that I'm annoyed. It's mostly me on camera, but there's a little bit of acting where, you know, it is just silly and fun. And I'm always happy when people do something in a good way or find one of my tricks. Honestly, I love it.
Tim Key, and the only reason I brought this up is because I spotted it in the credits once, that he's a task coordinator, is that the right
consultant.
Consultant.
Right.
Task
word, yeah.
Task consultant.
Mm.
And now, the way I picture it, right, genuinely, the way I picture it is just you and him sitting in a pub, just chatting and coming up with the most obscure tasks.
Yeah.
What is the process coming up with that sort of stuff?
Process is a generous word.
Okay.
Chris. Now, what happened was that when we started the show, so he's unfortunately probably my best friend.
Yeah.
And so when we started, I used him as a sounding board, but then he was in the show, so I couldn't test any of the tasks on him because that would ruin it. But I would always, he would always be the person I'd talk to about what's funny because he's very funny.
Phil Wang was the test.
Yeah, he came in. He was our first guinea pig. And then actually with Phil, we realized we don't really need to test the tasks because comedians come in and there's no point in predicting what they're going to do. Anyway, so the second series, when we're surprised enough to get that, I did start running the task by Tim. I said, what about if there was an egg on the table? I remember calling him up and said, what if there's an egg on the table and it said, eat me, fastest wins. What do you think about that? And he said, yeah, that's a good idea. So that was his role. And then the series after that, I kept talking to him and he suggested some things and I said, we should probably pay you for this. So we got him on board as a task consultant. And then after that moment, he virtually contributed nothing.
Okay.
Not true. Now, he's always been a sounding board. I call him at any point to talk about who would be a good contestant if a task needed a bit of work. He's at the other end of the phone. We don't meet up, really, to talk about things because we've got other more important things to talk about, like life. But he's just there, and it's fun to have his name. I think he's argued. I don't think he'll mind me telling you this. He's argued his way to a slightly smaller fee to the consternation of his agent. Because he has said slightly, he will tell you he's in charge of every task.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say it's somewhere in between the two.
Okay.
But yeah, it's not a very organized relationship. But I love having his name on the credit.
Yeah. How, I mean, after 18 series, what's your bank like of tasks just sitting in the back of your mind? Is it quite full still?
It's not bad. Yeah, no, it's not in the back of my mind. It's in the back of my phone. It's in the notes section, so I panic about losing that. But it's all right.
Mm-hmm.
You tend to think of a lot of tasks while you're doing tasks.
Mm-hmm.
That's when you're most fertile. No, I don't have a worry, except people more and more are asking me if the well is drying up.
Mm-hmm.
And I keep telling them that wells don't dry up. Wells are built near natural springs. So I'm hoping it's a natural spring in there, so it won't dry up unless there's an awful amount of climate change.
Yeah. I'm still hoping for the one that I suggested to you last year. I don't know if you remember it. It was literally just go to sleep, fastest wins.
So we did that. That went in.
You said to me, you said afterwards, it was a Julian Clary series.
Yeah.
there was something similar to it.
So what happens is, really, if people suggest something, normally, and this, don't want this to sound like a slight on anyone, normally I or we have thought of something similar.
Yeah.
Because after all that time, you tend to have covered a lot of bases. But someone might say something and it triggers something in there and something else will come up. I'm also slightly hesitant about taking someone's idea wholesale because it feels like we're nicking it and it feels unfair. But if something's good enough and I stress to them, look, I'd love to do that, but I can't. We can't credit you. That's not how telly works, unfortunately. Which is maybe not ideal, but anyway.
So as long as they know, though, I mean, that's the thing. They've came at you with the idea, so it's...
Yeah. But also, I think it's also me being slightly tiny and anal about it and just not wanting to anyone else to share the glory, which is awful. But no, yeah, something like that. Actually, go to sleep. We did think about it for a while, and there's lots of reasons why we didn't, which is normally the constraints of filming a TV show. Just the time.
I can imagine. In terms of contestants, and we're talking about the world drying up, but, you know, 18 series in, again, I suppose this question is twofold. First one being that, You are now in a position where I assume, and certainly by listening to Ed Gamble's podcast, that people are approaching you to come on now. Whereas, you know, at the beginning, you were clamouring to get people. So, who do you have? Like, do you have a dream contestant still? And secondly, I don't think there was a second one. It's blanked in my mind. Let's go with the dream contestant first.
Well, so, yeah, some people are asking to do the show, which is great. We are still very much asking people to do the show as well. I don't think we're running out. So that is a worry of mine, though, slightly. It helps to have a well-known person in the five. It helps to have someone that everyone knows already, because then you don't have to do the work of finding out about them, and you might be surprised by them. So we like to have someone who's very well-known, someone else who's pretty well-known, and the other three... Two of them are definitely going to be well-known in the comedy world, and then one who's hopefully not necessarily newer, but less well-known, who we can push forward with a bit of luck. There's people like Dawn French and Jennifer Saunders. I don't want to treat them as one, but either of them, I would love to. We'd come close.
Yeah.
Bill Bailey, Stephen Merchant, Lenny Henry. These are all on that first seat, you know, that they would be household names, and I just would love to see them do the thing. And they've all said positive things.
Good.
Some like Ross Noble, I would love to do the show. I mean, these are all, you know, that's six series worth of big names. So I'm not afraid. I think we will, hopefully, if we can make the timing work, get at least some of those people. Someone like Sarah Silverman, I would love to have, you know.
Oh, wow, that would be a great one, yeah.
Yeah. But then there's someone like Al Pitcher, who lives in Sweden, who's an old comic friend. I mean, there's a million people who I think are so funny, who deserve to be in the show, but there's only so many spaces. And we do try to be very representative of all types. So... You know,
yeah,
we try to make sure we have a balance of genders where possible. So there's only if you're a certain sort of person, there's only a certain amount of opportunities. So it's hard to get the balance. And so many people deserve to be on it. And we are suggested a lot of good people all the time. So, yeah.
So, because as far as I'm aware, and you can correct me on this, so the main show, main taskmaster is comedians. You know, mainly, and then when you do the
it's all comedy adjacent.
But when you do the specials, like the New Year's Treat, that's more just like actors or people in the public eye.
Yeah, we're actually trying to make it no comedians in that.
Okay,
unless we find out someone is desperate to do the show, but they could never ever commit to doing the full series. But say if we had, for example, Rich and Iwadi, say, I'd love to do the New Year special. I think we would say we would hold out to try to persuade them to do the full series.
Yeah,
because it'd be such a shame. Yeah, that's the system.
Yeah, so I've got one dream contestant that I would love to have on. Everybody's got one, I think. You've been suggested a million people a million times, no doubt. I would love to see Chris Moyles do it.
Ah, that's interesting. Radio X. Is that what it's called now? Yeah. X? Or just Radio?
No, Radio X, you were there.
So they've been great with us promoting the shows. We've often gone on the radio and done tasks with his team, with Dominic and... the others, and yeah, he's been great. So, and he's an interesting, thoughtful man, isn't he?
Yeah,
someone we've grown up with who maybe has changed over the years.
Very much so.
That's a good suggestion. Are you thinking main series or special?
I don't know, because he's not your traditional comedian, but he has a very funny mouth.
Yeah, so the not a problem. But I would see him, if you're listening, Chris. No offense, as very much perfect New Year's treat person, because as soon as you have someone who is not a comedian in the comedian's version, then it feels like you're saying no to all these comedians who've worked so hard.
Oh, yeah.
So that would be the only reason. Mm-hmm. But I agree. We've had someone like, I guess a similar one would be Adrian Childs. He did the New Year's Special.
He was great.
He could absolutely have been in the main series, mm-hmm. but that would be at the expense of a sort of hard-working comedian. So that would be my hesitation.
So I want to go back a wee bit now, because I want to know more about you, Alex.
Right.
Yeah. I think you are quite a private person, aren't you? You keep your private life kind of private. But how was your? You said this last night at the show, in terms of like growing up, you know, with your friends around, and then you know, trying to get into breaking into comedy and you know, television and things like that.
Can I say one thing though, Chris? First of all, this is just gradually sinking in. Oh. It's very nice of you. I don't want to sound flippant about this mm-hmm. at all, but I do think when they're saying thank you to me, what they're really saying thank you to is the show, which I'm definitely responsible for in some element, but I will definitely pass this around the team, I think,
okay,
just
good.
So you know. I'm trying to work out what to do with it, because it's the sort of thing, you know, what do you do? So anyway, that's what's been going on underneath the surface. Yes, getting into comedy.
Yeah, just getting into comedy, growing up in London, you know, all that sort of stuff. Just, who is Alex Horn?
Right, okay. So I think I'm private-ish, in that the more podcasts you do, mm-hmm. I said to you last night, I'd much prefer doing a podcast in real life, because then you have a genuine conversation. But I do a lot of podcasts, and Zoom is very helpful. So it does chip away at your private.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've talked about pretty much everything now.
Okay. Yes.
But I was, normal kid. So in the south coast of England with Ben and Joe, who were in the band. We were best friends then. We're still best friends now, along with Tim, I suppose. But they all know Tim as well. So I went to school. We all went to local primary school. Then I was hoiked out and went to private school. What did I say before? Primary. Yeah, I went from state primary to private school for various reasons. And, you know, it's something you've almost had to come to terms with, that I went through the private system. So I had an awful lot of privileges. And I went from there to Cambridge University, which again is an elitist privileged place, which was sort of, you know, it's an odd thing, because there was definitely a thing where people who went to Cambridge, especially white men, got a step up in the comedy world, which is sort of embarrassing and, you know, slightly shameful, or definitely was shameful. But there's no point flagellating yourself too much, because it's what's happened.
Yeah.
So there's no point. I think I did deny it. Well, I didn't necessarily deny it, but I didn't admit it for a while. But then it's there on Wikipedia, so no point pretending. So, yeah, so I went there, and I went to Cambridge not to do comedy at all, but I knew about Footlights, and I always had a love of comedy. Mm. I was shy. I like listening to things and reading things, and I like Monty Python and the Blues Brothers. Yeah, those are my influences, I suppose. And then things like, well, Bill Bailey and Sean Locke when I was 18. So I like comedy. I sought out the Footlights because I'd heard of it. I knew about Peter Cook. I knew about Fry and Laurie, and most of the people I'd heard of seemed to have been to Footlights. I didn't know what Footlights was, but I found it, and it was, when I went, it was essentially a open mic comedy club where you have to audition in front of four people, which is terrifying, to do it like a 90 second bit of it could be any sort of comedy. I would just did stand up, and then you do a comedy night if you got through, and that was my education in comedy, and starting doing competitions in London through Time Out magazine, and gradually built some sort of a setup, and then got an agent through that, and met people like Tim and Mark Watson, and yeah, took it from there. So I don't know, that's a short answer.
Yeah.
So I was pretty shy, but also confident enough to put myself forward for some reason. That was quite out of character. But I'd been funny at home with my parents and my brothers and grandparents, so I thought I could make people laugh.
Mm-hmm.
And it's simple, if you can make your family laugh, you can probably make other people laugh, I think.
I mean, my girls, I make their eyes roll when I get the, you know, that one.
But you must have made them laugh once.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, 100%, yeah. Although I've never seen my wife laugh as much as she did last night.
Well, I suppose that's good.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a brilliant show. But that's the other thing I want to ask you. Where did the music and comedy kind of fusion thing come from?
So, as I talk about in the show, so Joe and Ben became jazz musicians very early. So when we were kids, they had a band called Matrix with a Y, which I was never in, if I couldn't do anything. Ben would play drums at home, piano at home, everything. And Joe was just an amazing trumpeter from a very musical family. And they played everything initially. They played all the instruments. And we once went to Chichester Youth Orchestra. I auditioned once and was so out of my depth, so never again. So I would follow them around the jazz circuit as they got bigger and bigger. Mm. And they would come to Edinburgh playing in bands, and I would come to Edinburgh doing comedy. So I would watch them and they would watch me. They had a love of comedy. I had a love of music. Neither of us really understood each other's worlds. And then it was the same year that we did Taskmaster for the first time. We did the horn section for the first time. So it was definitely necessity of having a child, you know, had to come up with something. So that year, actually, Mark from the band had suggested it. He got me along to Ronnie Scott's. He does a show called Soul Family at Ronnie Scott's once a month. And they invited me as a comedian. I think I was the first comic to play with them, to do something with the band. And it worked. So we said, let's do it. Let's make our own band. We booked 8 nights in Edinburgh, same room as Taskmaster at the Dome. 8 nights at midnight, where we would be a backing band, essentially, and I'd invite comics to come on. Some new, some old, like Jimmy Carr was really supportive at the beginning, like Tim Minchin did it. So they would come on, do their sets, but the band would play along. Because I think live music, there's nothing like live music and seeing tons of people close up. So it kind of worked. It was comedy, but heightened. Sometimes it wouldn't work, and that was fine too. But it was raw and in the moment. Mm-hmm. And gradually we've got rid of the other comics because it didn't work financially. So it's just, now it's just us 15 years on. But occasionally, like Sam Campbell's coming to do our Christmas show. Mm. So occasionally we have a comic on, normally Tim Key. But they come on and they will experiment with us and say, okay, I need a beat. Mm-hmm. And they'll tell a joke to a beat. And it's really fun.
I love how talented those guys are as well. Like they are, you can just ask them for anything that you want. And within seconds, they'll just... And how in tune they are with each other. Because I remember listening to the podcast, there was something, I can't remember specifically what it was, but you had asked for something and they just went.
Yeah, they're pretty good. So... It's annoying. Yeah. Yeah, they are. I mean, what they are is musicians. You know, yeah. That's the language they speak and that's what they do. And I'm the same as you. I'm in awe of them when they can do that. And I would love them to show off more, but they're quite embarrassed about it. They think it's not cool to do like a trumpet solo.
Yeah.
They think, oh, come on, that's not what they're here for. But I think you're right. People would love to see that. And they take for granted their talent, I think. Mm. But they're really good. They're really good. I mean, they're also hopeless humans, you know. We're all nearly 50 and bumbling along. But yeah, they are very good at music. There's no denying that.
Pretty much living the dream just now. If you reckon being a front man in the band... Plus, you got your own TV show.
Well, it's good to hear that because you do need to remember that. And often, I wake up, I don't know about you, I don't feel great when I wake up.
Yeah.
I'm so tired and my body's hurting just from life and
age.
Yeah, not sleeping very well sometimes. And I have to remember that things are good. And especially compared to, oh my God, you know, if you look at the news,
and
you think, oh yeah, I thought things are going pretty well. And it is really fun. So we're on this tour, which is lasting till the end of next year. And it is really fun. So we're in Scotland at the moment. So I saw an old friend last night. The best thing about the tour is catching up with old friends and family.
And new friends.
And new friends like you. Seeing you in person, finally. And we're off to Aberdeen after this. We get the train together and it's beautiful looking out the window. So stuff like that. It's good to remember we're not in an office and we're not sedentary and we're doing anything we love. So yeah, things are good.
Mm-hmm. How important is resilience in your industry, in your life? You know, like, to give you a prime example, right, because we mentioned this last night, that I don't give up on any
of that, Chris.
This is 2 years in the making, this. It's been 2 years.
I would love to read out some of the messages you sent me.
Oh.
Hi, Alex. It's me again.
Yep. Yep. I'm asking you again.
Any chance? You're very polite, always.
Of course. Because, you know, if I'm going to go, Alex, you...
Yeah, yeah.
We wouldn't be sitting here though.
You've been gaslighting me, Alex, 2 years now.
But yeah, it's been 2 years, but I don't give up. And that's the thing, like, I always say that you can't defeat somebody who never gives up. And I don't have a choice. You know, I still haven't got my break yet. I'm still working towards that. I thought it was going to be the book, the Lucid Blue Day book, and the pandemic hit, and that kind of ruined everything. Hopefully something good will come of this podcast. That's what I'm hoping for. But how important in the kind of entertainment industry is that resilience?
Yeah, when you first asked me, I thought you said Brazilians.
Ah, okay. Well, how important are Brazilians as well?
Yeah, weirdly, there was a little group of Brazilians who are quite supportive of us on Twitter, which was that was our first time we found out there's a fan somewhere else in the world. It was in Brazil.
Yeah.
And they were very important to us. So hello, Brazil. No, you're very inspiring saying all that in terms of you not giving up. And you're right. It is unfair. The people who get the break and people who don't. But the only way to get the break is to keep going. If you stop, then you won't get the break.
Exactly.
Like, as you know. And who knows when or where or how. But I'm sure it will happen. And you've just got to keep going. So, yeah. So, I mean, I was fairly late in that I was in my 30s when I had any success. So, I was getting there, but I wasn't getting any money, you know, and I was lucky in that I had family who, I never felt that they weren't sort of financing my comedy, but if I really had nothing, they would have supported me.
Yeah.
Which is amazing. And I had a wife who was absolutely, I still have, but she was absolutely the breadwinner. And she had also allowed me to go off and try to fulfill my dream, you know, going to Edinburgh every year, losing money. And it wasn't really tough because it's so fun.
Uh-huh.
But if I thought about it too much, it would have been like, okay, this isn't working. So I think it's resilience, but it's also optimism. I think it might come from a privileged background that I always feel like everything's going to work out, which is an unfair. That's maybe what the public school system does for you. It does give you confidence.
Yeah.
And I think it's a real shame.
Can't feel out, Tori, isn't it?
We wait for that to go.
Don't worry about that. I can edit that in post. Don't you worry.
I think, having my own kids now who are in the state system, you do worry about kids getting lost in that system because there are so many kids, 30 kids in a class, and to a certain extent you have to go at the pace of the slowest runner, and which is, you know, brilliant. And most of their classes has been a couple of other teachers because so many people, maybe it's a pandemic, so many people have issues now. And yes, so I don't know, if I haven't had that background, would I have had the resilience and optimism that I've got? Hopefully.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's innate, and maybe it's just my parents being supportive. But, yeah, I definitely worry about kids not having that resilience or confidence or self-belief.
Yeah, I think especially over the past few years, there's been a lot of different things coming out in terms of, like, children. Because I know my kids, after spending, you know, 2 or 3 years in the house, and then going back to school, there's an innate difference between how they are and how, say, I was, okay, 30 years ago, mind you, but, you know, there is something just not there.
Mm-hmm.
Do you follow me? I'm not exactly the right ones here, but so I understand the worry in that sense, but what I think we need to remember, and this is something that I had to remember when everything was going wrong at the pandemic, is that we were all in the same boat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every 10-year-old has had that gap in their education. So,
yeah, and there's definitely some positives.
Yeah.
I mean, whether it was spending more time as a family, going for walks,
mm-hmm.
you know, you discovered a lot about each other, and I discovered how good teachers are, you know, compared to me. But, yeah, that's definitely probably won't know till later. It's hard to know how much to attribute to the pandemic and how much attribute to mobile phones, for example. But going back to your question, I think it's a really key quality, much more important in comedy than being funny. The funniest people don't necessarily always make it because they might not have the resilience of someone who, and this might sound like being falsely modest, but I'm definitely not in the top 100 people I know, you know, in terms of being funny. Mm-hmm. But I stick around and keep going, and I associate with funnier people and more creative people. I think that's the other thing, is surrounding yourself with people who are positive and talented is useful. If you can hang on their coattails, that'll do.
Well, now that we're friends, I'll be hanging off you.
Perfect. Well, I'm hanging off a lot of people, so
we'll just hang together. Working together. I spent the last August there, a month here in Edinburgh as well, interviewing different talent who were here for the Fringe, the new talent, and some of the older ones as well. And the one thing that I found that every single one of them had is how hard it is working the Fringe and working the festival, selling tickets, the amount of money you have to spend, all that sort of stuff. How was your Fringe experience with that? And was there ever any thought of just going, this is a bit much?
Well, that's a good question. I don't think I ever found it difficult. I need to qualify that. It was always exhausting and long, and probably too long. But I actually really loved it so much. And being here today, I really, really love looking around Edinburgh when the festival's not on, and the memories come flooding back, and it was the happiest time.
Two cousins taking different life paths discuss the highs and lows of being in your 30s, and nothing is off limits. This is Life in Your 30s. This is 30 Old, 30 Young.
I mean, there's lots of happy times, but I think it was up there. So my wife and I first, just after we got together, so we met when we were 18, but we got together when we were 20, and we had a festival here, my first ever Edinburgh, year 2000. And so there's that memory, and then building up stand-up sets, and I did my first show with Tim Key, and that was a brilliant memory, and we got nominated for the award, so we've kind of kicked, it worked straight away. Actually, in 1999, I did So You Think You're Funny, so that was a fun memory. So it was all... I think I got lucky in that it was always a positive experience, but I had my first review was a 1-star review in Chortle, which is still there. So I definitely had times where we didn't sell any tickets, got bad reviews, but I never really, I think I loved it so much just being at the festival.
Mm-hmm.
So I know I always enjoyed it, but I know that's quite abnormal. One year I shared a room with Greg Davis, as in it was my show, then his show. So you overlap with comedy. Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I pictured when you said share a room, I was picturing you and him head to toe on a double bed.
Yeah, that's everyone's dream, but no, it was
just... Oh, I've read that stuff. Don't even lab. Oh, my goodness.
No, we had a very different Edinburgh, though. He got nominated for the Perrier, and it went very well for him. I had a very ordinary fringe, didn't really make any impression on anyone. But I was happy, and he was not, for some reason. I think he found the pressure of the award bore down on him a bit, and I think he will say himself, he doesn't love Edinburgh as much as I did, and then maybe that's a personality thing. And maybe, again, it's because... he had sacrificed a lot to be there. His teaching job, he'd come to it later, whereas I was just sort of...
just stuck.
Yeah, happy-go-lucky person who had nothing to lose. So I think it was from a place of position, a privilege again.
Yeah.
But no, I never found it tough, and I always, always loved it.
So your relationship with Greg then came way before Taskmaster?
Yeah. We knew each other for a long time, did gigs together. We weren't friends, but we knew each other enough. Mm-hmm. Definitely got on. But he wasn't amongst those 20 comics who I invited to do it because he wasn't in my close circle. But we did, yeah, we became friends on camera, really.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, so it was, I definitely trusted him before, which is why I asked him to do it. And he trusted me enough to say yes. So yeah, we knew each other.
And what made you make the decision then for him? Or was it your decision to have him be the host, I guess, host of your show?
Yeah, no, it was always the plan for me not to do it because of my personality not being strong enough, or being a different sort of personality anyway. And if we're completely blunt about it, needed a bigger name to actually get off the ground. And he was a bigger name, still is. You know, he's great. He's one of the funniest people in the country. And it was just funny to have this big guy with his authority, his teacher training. So, no, it was always a plan. I think it was with Avalon as well, the production company. We both agreed, oh, but yeah, he was the obvious choice.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, the dream probably would have been someone like Lisa Tarbuck, i.e. not two white men
telling other people
what to do. It's not a great look, and I don't quite know how we've got away with it. But I think we're hopefully knowing enough that this is a ridiculous situation, and we're the butt of a lot of the jokes. But, we've got Junior Taskmaster starting soon, and Rose Matafeo is the taskmaster and Mike Wozniak is the assistant, and that feels like a much healthier dynamic rather than two wealthy men being in charge, which is embarrassing.
But I love both of them, Rose and Mike. Two, and I'll say this right now because I know I'm going to get Alex to share this, two of my dream interviewees.
Okay.
Out there.
Both lovely people too, and they will probably fob you off far fewer times than I did.
and I won't stop. What's the concept of Junior Taskmaster then? How are the kids coping with it?
Yeah, it's a good question again. Yes, another good question, Chris.
I'd try. I've had 2 years worth of questions here. But, you know?
Right. Well, so Junior Taskmaster has happened because we started doing it in schools. I went to my local, where my kids go to do primary school. I did a Taskmaster day, and it was immediately obvious that kids are good at tasks, and they don't have the filters that adults do. They're funny. They are quite heartwarming. It's good to get kids out there being kids. I think the main show is basically grown-ups being kids. So this is kids being kids, or sometimes kids being grown-up. So the idea was, let's see if we can do that on telly. there's a bit of a history of Junior Bake Off. I think is one of the best programs. Harry Hill is so brilliant with the kids. But the actual kids themselves, we did a lot of work on this. So they're years 5 and 6 in the school system in England. I think that's P6 and P7 here.
What?
So the last 2 years of primary
school. Right, okay, yeah.
6 and 7. Between 9 and 11 mm-hmm. years old. So they are pre-secondary school. So they don't quite have that sense of worry about how they appear.
Mm-hmm.
But they are competent and confident enough to do the thing. Often the 9-year-old girls are as mature as the 11-year-old boys, you know, the way things are. So yeah, 9, 10, 11-year-old kids. They are from the real world. They're not sort of theatre kids.
Mm-hmm.
So we found them by going to schools and asked teachers to push people forward who they thought could cope mm-hmm. psychologically and also would be interesting to watch. Again, we try to get the breadth of types of brain, types of personality, types of physical ability,
mm-hmm.
trying to make it as broad as possible. And then there's all sorts of layers of psychological tests of both the kids and the parents, background checks. It's a bit of a nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
We have to employ people who are brilliant at that, who've had plenty of experience of, you know, working with kids. And the way it works is there's 25 kids. So there's 5 in each episode for 5 episodes.
Okay.
And the top 2 go through to the semifinals. So then you have 10 kids.
Mm-hmm.
And then the top 5 out of those 10 go through to the final. And one kid eventually wins, which means you have 24 kids who you're telling have lost.
I can't.
Yeah, 24 kids who you have to let down.
Can't even do musical statues.
But I think it's really good for them. So Rose is very good in the same way as Greg is. It's just taking no prisoners and saying, yeah, that was rubbish. And I think it's so important to... It's not that thing of, you know, if you're very anti-woke, you'll say, isn't it? It's bad that there are no losers anymore. You know, everyone wins. Everyone gets a medal. And I think there's somewhere... There's definitely a grain of truth in that, that I think it's important for kids to not always be told they are wonderful. Sometimes it's okay to tell a kid you've done that badly. And I think the kids we've had, they all know the show. They all know the main show. They know that the funny bits is when you fail. And they're not afraid of failure. And we tell them very quickly, the most likely scenario here is that you're going to lose. And we didn't have tears. We didn't have anyone get upset. But we did have to work on that and make sure they were resilient enough. And
as a word again?
Yeah. And open enough to being mocked.
Mm-hmm.
Because the show would be awful if everyone won. And my favourite people in the main show are always the people who've come last.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I love it. I don't know if these people came last, but they didn't win. You know, a Daisy May Cooper or a Johnny Vegas.
Yeah, Nish Kumar.
Nish Kumar was famously bad at it and very funny for it. I think, in a way, if I was on the show, it's difficult because my competitive nature, I'd want to win.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, if you win in the show, you often don't win the show. You don't win the... You know, the whole point is to be funny and not to try to be funny, but just to be yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, the kids, we really had to tell them, don't worry if you do badly. I mean, what Rose found tough was the very first round. So we do a prize task where they have to bring in the thing
mm-hmm.
that fits the category best. And Rose has to very quickly say to somebody, well, last place is this person. And they thought about what to bring in
mm-hmm. long
and
hard.
They think it's good. So you have to let them down quick. But, you know, then you've broken the ice. And they get a big round of applause and it's a very supportive atmosphere. But they are in a grown-up studio on those chairs facing 2 grown-ups on thrones. So it's pretty unusual.
Was that a difficult sell to Channel 4 or was it?
I think the worry was we didn't want to... there's quite a lot of Taskmaster about.
Mm.
We don't want to dilute it too much. We don't want to have people getting sick of it. Or we don't want to appear like we're milking it, which I'm sure it does. But there's board games that's...
Mm-hmm.
VR games as a live experience, blah blah blah. But Junior was always going to be different. That there was talk of Greg and I doing it, which we were sort of up for, but time prevented that. And actually, I think it's so good to have different people doing
mm-hmm.
it. So yeah, it wasn't too hard to sell. There was lots of chat about it. We want to get it right, but we didn't do a pilot. They did green light it straight away. Oh. But we don't know if we're doing any more of it. I think we won't know until this has gone out.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm really hopeful because I think it's really good. I think it's funny and heartwarming. It's different from the main show. I think it's family viewing,
mm-hmm.
8 o'clock on a Friday. So I think it is, you sit down with your kids and watch it. You could definitely watch it as grown-ups, but I imagine you're more likely to watch it if you have kids yourself.
How are we doing time-wise? Okay, good.
I'm good.
Okay, so where was I? We're talking about Taskmaster, Kids Task. Oh, yeah, okay, Worldwide Taskmaster is where I want to go now, okay? Again, I understand that it's a team thing and it's a whole kind of team behind it, but at the end of the day, this is still your creation. And this is something that you've created that is now all over the world. Right, so you've got, I believe New Zealand is probably the next most popular one.
I think Sweden, weirdly.
Oh, wow.
Like they do it on a Saturday night, and it's one of their sort of, it's like Britain's Got Talent, which is very strange. New Zealand's lovely. And
it's not in English, is it? It's not in English language,
no,
is it?
No. No, it's not called Task Master either. It's Bestie Test.
Yes, as I've seen it.
Because I think the word task, I may be wrong, I say this a few times, I think task means dick in Sweden.
That would, that'd be a completely different show, wouldn't it?
Exactly. I was, you know, tempted to see how it would go down. But, it's pretty weird.
Were you surprised to see any particular country pick up?
Every country is a surprise. So we first got picked up in Belgium, which I don't think they stuck with it. So we went to the recording, me and the two Andys, the two Andys and I went to Belgium, watched it in Flemish, didn't understand a word of it, but did find it really funny because it's still the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
These five people, you get the idea of what's going on. They're all trying these things in different ways. And it did hit me then that I suddenly thought, oh, yes, good format, this. Because as soon as you see one person do it, you want to see how the rest of them do it. So, yeah, it surprised me they were doing it. And then when I watched it, I did think, oh, I can see how it translates because it's not really a British thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's just humans doing things. But it's always a surprise because it's also such a basic concept. You sort of think, well, let's do your own. I'm surprised when people, you know, don't just make up their own versions.
I suppose what do you call it now? The
copyright?
Yeah, copyright. Intel.
Yeah.
Intellectual property.
That's the one.
I suppose that's,
I think you can get away with it. I hope they're not listening, but I think you can get away with it. Just have six people.
Give me a few weeks.
Yeah.
Taskmaster Scotland.
Yeah.
I want your honest opinion here, okay? The US version.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel that went?
Well, I feel quite a lot of things. So it was really, I think I'm an optimist. It was really fun. So I had 6 weeks living in LA with Andy, filming the tasks in this beautiful house, blue sky every day, with really great contestants. The contestants are brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
And then Reggie is one of my comedy heroes, Reggie Watts, the Taskmaster. Studio was really fun, mad. We lived at 9 o'clock in the morning in LA with this audience who were sort of drafted in to whoop and cheer, and they whooped far too much. And then the program went out, and I watched it. It's 22 minutes long, and I thought, I think it was pretty good, but I didn't have a clue. And it sort of disappeared without a trace very quickly. But I did go out there, and there was billboards of me and the cast, and that was so exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And looking back, I could see very clearly why it didn't work, which I think was that there were so many compromises that we said it was Comedy Central, and we said yes to everything they suggested.
Right.
So I think Reggie would be a brilliant taskmaster with a different assistant. I think the two of us didn't necessarily have an awful lot of chemistry. He would also be an absolutely brilliant contestant, which may be that he would be fit better in that role. 22 minutes is far too brief. You couldn't really get stuck into it. So we had to change the format a little bit. So the prize task was different. Only one person brought it in. So you're off to a weird start. It was very rushed. There's an advert every 6 minutes, literally.
That's American TV, though, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think everything should get a second series. I think if we did it again, we would have changed some elements.
Mm-hmm.
I think you need time to let something bed in. But in general, I think it wasn't as good as the British version. I think if we did it again, we would just do it the way we do it here, which is what the other countries do. They all do it pretty much the same. So I think we just changed it too much.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, we were pretty young and naive, and it was really exciting. And I do think, in general, television networks know their audience more than I do. So if Portugal suggests something, I normally go, yeah, if you think that'll work, go for it. And it's the same with America. It's a whole, I don't understand American TV. I still don't really know what network television is compared to cable or streaming. Yeah. I don't really understand it. So we just went along with it. We had a lovely time. If it had worked, I think my life might have gone completely wrong because I would have been in America half the year.
Yeah.
It would have been miles away, or they would have been traveling between the two. And I don't think I would have been up for it. So I think things have worked out. And with a bit of luck, we're going to try again.
Yeah.
But ideally with Greg and me, or two American hosts, but I think we would just have more control over it.
What was it you did a couple of months ago in New York?
We just got invited on the Seth Meyers chat show because it's sort of got some sort of reach over there because of YouTube and people like it. And Seth Meyers knew the show and his writers knew it. So we got invited on. And while we were there, we did a Q&A session and we did a premiere of the new series.
That's what it was. It was a premiere. It was queued during the block. You had to turn people away.
Yeah, it was very surreal. We did it in a club called Rodney's in New York. think that's what it's called. Rodney Dangerfield's club. Mm-hmm. And I might have got that wrong. But anyway, it was really exciting, really surreal. People queued, travelled for miles, wore lots of unofficial merch. Like, where did you get that from? And it was really good. So I think we're going back in January doing something similar. So it's only because we had a lovely time. Like, Greg and I found it so exciting mm-hmm. to realise that people knew it in America.
And that's that must give you hope then for a second series or a new version to bring it back to America.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we're not pinning our hopes on it because I don't think we're too old to think this could launch us in America. And I don't really want to be launched anywhere. I'm really happy where I am. But if we could have a go, mm-hmm. I think we would say yes, as long as the conditions were right.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think we look back with any sort of worries or regret. But yeah, it is interesting. We are thinking, well, I wonder if someone will come knocking. So we're not asking, we're waiting to be asked.
Right. Talk to me about Chesham.
Okay.
Chesham FC. What is the... Why do you love that club so much? Why? There's such a small... For me, certainly looking at it, such a small club.
Mm.
I certainly wouldn't have heard of it unless I was watching Taskmaster or heard of you. Why have you got such an affiliation, such a love for that just little football club that's just down the way?
Well, I guess it's a lot of things. So I've lived in Chesham for maybe 18 years, and my kids are all born there and play for the local, the youth teams, which doesn't mean they're good at football. They're pretty good, but it just means anyone can play for the youth
team.
Mm-hmm. But it's crept up on me, this thing. I think at the start, to my shame, I thought it was quite funny going to the non-league football club, seeing, oh, this will be a laugh. Let's see how bad they are. And they were pretty good. And they were instantly, you go, oh God, these are proper athletes. So that changed pretty quick. But we did some filming it
mm-hmm.
at the club through Taskmaster. So I got to know the people behind the scenes a bit. And then we started using the club more and more because it's a great space. And I do think football clubs, a bit like churches, should be used
mm-hmm.
for things other than football and religion. Because they're such big things in the community. So we started doing that. And then we realised actually the football is also a big thing in the community. And the people who play it, they're semi-professionals, so they're teachers and they are electricians and they're personal trainers and also brilliant footballers. So I got to know them a bit, got to know the managers and the chairman. And the chairman invited me to be on the board because I did an event at Chesham, which he also thought, this is how you get people through the door.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just sort of grown on me and you can see the effect it has on people, makes everyone happy, makes everyone proud of their town. Probably a bit of guilt as well in that I'm very lucky to be making a good living, doing something I love. Mm-hmm. If I can support something else, that's great. You know, it works for everyone. Makes me feel like a slightly better person on the shallow level. I'm a Liverpool fan and I am ashamed of that. I have been for years. You know, I grew up in the 80s, 1985, I was six and they'd done the double. So why would I not support them? My dad didn't push me in his direction, which was Tottenham. So I just, you know, I'm a Liverpool fan. But I know I'm a Glory fan, but you can't change. But I love being a Liverpool fan and a Chesham fan because mm-hmm. it feels like that's a weight off my back. So I'm going to Anfield this Saturday. I was at Chesham last Saturday. So that's a good balance.
How was it last night? Because I know you missed the game last night.
Yeah, the big FA Cup game, which they lost quite heavily, 4-0. But there was nil all until the 44th minute. So it was looking exciting. But I was on stage. There was a tiny, tiny, tiny part of me that was pleased that I hadn't missed the greatest night of Cheshire's life. But I wish they'd got through, obviously. But it was in the back of my mind the whole game, the whole show, which is a shame. So apologies, people of Edinburgh. When there's a night like that, so there was huge, there was 4,000 people there, which there used to be 200 people there. So it was mm-hmm. massive. And everyone's talking about it. The kids are wearing the kit and it's brilliant. So yeah, it's not it's sort of a forced love,
mm-hmm.
but it's sort of, it is definitely true. And a natural thing that's just emerged.
And do you feel, and again, I know you're very kind of grounded and humble when it comes to this sort of thing, but do you feel responsible for that, the fact that there was like 4,000 people there last night, or partly responsible, or do you feel you helped?
Well, I definitely think I didn't hinder, and I do think I'm part of this momentum that's built. But we got very lucky. So last season was the first time we had Taskmaster on their shirt,
yeah.
and they instantly won 7 games on the trot, and were top of the league, and we stayed top of the league for the whole season. And I think it can't be that instant an effect.
Yeah.
It can't just be you have this magic word on your shirt and you win. But it definitely helped. So they won, which means more people come and watch, and then they see the shirt and think, oh, I might get that because I've heard of the TV show. They were more happy to wear that thing. And people around the world bought it because it felt like a Taskmaster product. And all the money went to the club, so that felt good. So everyone won.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, I'm definitely proud to be part of that. definitely, I've never, people say, so are you in the dressing room talking to the managers in their ears? There's nothing like that. I'm in awe of the managers. I'm in awe of the players. I feel like a little kid talking to them, you know. I think they have no interest in me. The players particularly, they're half my age. People don't watch telly anymore. So they're aware of Taskmaster because we're, you know, involved in the club. But I'm much more excited about them than they're excited about me. So I stay well out of it. And I'm very rarely go to board meetings because I'm normally on tour. But I'm involved enough to get to talk about it, and that's my main role.
My wife came up with this question for you, right? And I think it's really, really deep, and that's why I want to ask you about it.
Okay, this is Lisa.
Yeah, Lisa. Yeah.
Okay. She's very nice to meet her. Yes, you insisted, and I think you're right that we meet up before, so it's not just me cold.
Yeah, yeah. I agree. Although 2 years of messaging,
true. You're not cold. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so she'd asked me this question, and it came from the fact that Taskmaster sponsored the Chesham shirts. Obviously, you're very successful in terms of your career, and you're doing well, you're making a good living, all that sort of stuff. If you had the success that you've got now in your early 20s, how do you think that would have went?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know. I think I'm very happy that I didn't.
Mm.
I think it's much better to come late after you've got kids. So I think everything changed for me when I had kids. And I was quite nervous about stand-up. And I was probably, like I said before, I was never hugely affected by it. I didn't have real swings.
Mm.
But if a gig went badly, I definitely felt bad. Whereas as soon as I had a kid, I didn't care anymore. Because you've got that thing at home that isn't quite important. So, yeah, I was quite pleased to have success after children. Because it means you really are grounded, I think. I think if you have it when you're 15, I don't really want to talk about it, but like Liam Payne, clearly success at a young age can bring some pretty tricky things. And someone like Kevin Bridges was successful very young, and he seemed extremely grounded. Oh, by the way, he would be a dream contestant.
Oh, God, yeah.
One of the funniest people.
I think you would need to invest in a bigger bleep button for him.
I think we could cope. Well, we got quite close with Kevin, and I think we're going to keep trying. But anyway, sorry. I think in comedy it might be different to pop music, for example, because you can only get success if you earn it in comedy. You have to make people laugh. You can't get it by looks alone or an image. But I think psychologically, for me anyway, much better having had to work for it for 10, 15 years. But in terms of what you do with it is interesting. Like, so I do earn, and it's like crude to talk about it, but I earn a good living. I don't really know what to do with it because I don't want to buy a flashy car. We've got a house that fits us all. We love our house. Mm-hmm. It's in the middle of the town. And it's top. You know, it's great. It's a lovely house compared to most people's others. But it's not. Anyway. But I think because I've got kids, the money basically, you just think, well, you know, that's for them. Because who knows what life's going to be like in 5 years when they're grown up. So that's probably a thing that if I had the success when I was in my 20s, I would have wasted it.
Yeah.
Much more fun things than the future.
Do you still have the red Scenic? Was it a Scenic?
I don't have a red Scenic. I've still got Fords. Wait,
it was a Ford. It was a Ford. It was the one that was out of the
Ford van, yeah.
Yeah.
I love my van. That's some of my happiest times are driving my van. No, we've got a Ford garage in Chesham. I'm quite loyal to Chesham, so we only drive Fords because we know the people who run it, and I really have a massive, and I apologize to mechanics out there, but I don't trust mechanics because I don't know anything about cars. And so I always felt like it's being ripped off. But in the Ford garage, I know them and I think at least I know them.
Yeah.
If they rip me off. So that's it. I'm sure there are many, many trustworthy mechanics, but I like going back to the same place.
No, we don't. I know.
There's a Ford. That's a Mercedes. I'm sorry. I'm so bad at cars.
Is it Rishi Sunak?
Yeah, yeah.
I forgot what I was going to say now. I had it there. What were we talking about?
Success coming young.
Oh, yeah. So, obviously, I know people don't really like to talk about them, but there's a really nice thing that Kevin Spacey once said, which was that when you get successful and you're at the top, we send the elevator back down to bring more people up with
you. That's a good thing to say. Well done, Kevin, for that.
Yeah, for that. So obviously, is that something that you're doing with the guys in the horn section? Obviously, you're bringing them with you. Because At the end of the day, you're the face of that thing. You literally says the horn section. You know,
yeah.
Is that important to you to bring other people with you?
Okay, so I could sound so patronizing here. I could also stop doing the horn section. In terms of life, would be a lot easier without it because there's a lot of travel. I'm already quite busy doing Taskmaster. I could easily have stopped it, but I'm definitely not doing it out of goodwill to the band.
Okay.
I'm doing it because I really enjoy it.
Yeah.
There's definitely a part of me that I'm very glad that they get to benefit from it, and we definitely sell more tickets because of Taskmaster, and there's plenty of people in that audience who've never seen the horn section before, but hopefully we can convert them. So I'm pleased that it has a knock-on effect for other people, but that's not what I'm doing it. I wish I could say it's selfless, and I'm... Mm-hmm. But no, I love it. And if everything else stopped, I would keep doing the horn section until I'm 80 because it's so much fun. And it gets more fun the older you get because it's pretty stupid. There's definitely a sense with Taskmaster that we try to make sure there's someone on the show who deserves a boost. But again, that could sound patronizing. They'll probably get that boost anyway. But it does feel good that you could promote someone, you know, a John Kearns or a Sam Campbell. There's many, many examples of that. I mean, even when we started... Ramesh did not need the boost. He would have got there anyway. But it feels like we got the crest of a wave. And maybe we didn't hinder that, you know, if we can take some credit for his career. Which, as I say, he would have got there probably quicker without us. But so, no, it feels good to help people. But I can't admit that I'm not philanthropic enough to say that's my goal.
Why not? Eh?
But I think that's a great thing to say. And it's more, actually, I do still go back to the primary school to do that. And I do lots of stuff with Taskmaster at education, so I feel the responsibility there, I suppose, and that is,
and what you've done with Chesham as well, like the football club, that's kind of you've helped bring them off a bit as well.
Yeah, but I think I benefit enough from that.
Okay,
in terms of just ego.
Yeah.
I love it that I feel like I'm doing good, and whereas the school stuff, that takes quite a lot of my time, and I don't get anything back from that, except I really love seeing the kids do it. So maybe there's about 1/100th of the stuff I do is it's for good reasons.
why not I promised Lisa that I would try and get a scoop off you.
Okay.
Right?
I'm not hard to break down, but...
We are about 2 weeks away from finding out...
Cast.
...for the cast for the next season.
When does this podcast go out?
I plan on editing it today and putting it out tomorrow.
Okay, I need to be careful then.
So 2 weeks away from finding out the next cast. Is it Series 19 cast, or is it New Year's treat?
I don't know. I imagine we're going to reveal the 19th cast. That's what we normally do. So I would say here, you haven't directly asked me your question yet.
Okay. I will directly ask you then. Can you tell me anybody that's in the 19 cast?
I get so much trouble for this. So the Reddit community, I'm definitely not on Reddit. Cause if I go there, I will never come out of there. But they are amazing. So we find out that they found out who's on things. And they find out things in various ways. But I don't even want to say how they do it because it would potentially let more people do it. They're quite good, from what I've heard, of saying, spoiler alert, don't read this if you don't want to know. Because I think it's really good not to spoil things. And a lot of people don't want to know the cast.
Mm-hmm.
But we did drop we tried to sort of offer Easter eggs and tidbits for people. And if you dig deep enough, find out. So there was something that happened in the show. A clue was hidden in a section early in the show. Last week, I think, where you could find out something to do with the future cast.
Okay.
So we've put it out there, and I imagine people have worked it out from that. But people have also found it out by tracking people's comedians' movements. They know where we film the show. It's amazing where people can find out. I can't tell you anyone who's in it. I can tell you, and I have said this before, we have an American on the show, someone who doesn't live in the UK. We've had Americans before, but they tend to have been people who've moved here. Whereas this time, for the first time, we have someone, a resident in America, who's flown over to do it. So that's exciting. We have...
In terms of your I always say it's a legend chair. In terms of your legend, are you pleased with it? Are you... Because this year you've got Jack D sitting there. You know, Jack D is like... He's comedy royalty.
Completely. I think this year, actually, there's less of that. There's... Comedy's so funny. Like, I think of people as a household name, and then I mention them to my parents, and they haven't got a clue who that is. Or they suddenly have heard of Sam Campbell, for example.
Yeah.
So there isn't necessarily a Jack D figure.
Okay.
The sort of a grandfather of British comedy. There isn't that position. It's slightly more equal, slightly more mad. It's a pretty unusual lineup. There's someone that you that a lot of people are really familiar with, but again, you may not have heard of them. I think you will have heard of all five. There's a pretty weird mix. I really want it to be surprising. I want people to predict the lineup, and I love it when no one has predicted any of them. So, yeah, I'm really pleased with it. It's pretty odd. I don't think, for me, I don't think a name sells it. I don't think people are tuning in for a name. I think they're hopefully tuning in for the show. I have a perennial fear that this is going to be the year that everyone goes, no, I hate this lot. But they always say, oh, I prefer the old lot. And then after episode two, they go, oh, I'm in. This is the lot for me. And I think you've got to trust the format and trust.
Do you have a favourite season?
No, it's normally the previous season.
Yeah.
I'm really fond of season one because we didn't think it would carry on. And that, you know, those guys did it without knowing, you know, they put themselves out there. They didn't know what this program was going to end up being. Whereas now people can trust it more. But no, I don't have a favourite season. I mean, I really loved the lockdown ones because it gave me a way out. But it was weird looking back at that.
And yeah, exactly. I really, really enjoyed watching them, but I can't go back.
Yeah, it feels weird. And there was such funny stuff in that, you know, with Mike Wozniak, for example. Oh, there's 15 people. We had three series on.
You tried to get him to fart. That was hilarious.
Yeah. Oh. And part of me thinks, oh, it's such a shame with those 15 comics that they didn't have the audience. But equally, they got us through something and they were special in their own right. And I love looking back and thinking that was part of history without sounding too grand. So no, I don't think I could commit to a favourite series. Quite often I catch some. We do these compilation shows, which we really try to. What's the word? There's a word for. It's like when you curate, we try to curate them. We, Greg and I, do voiceovers. They're written by a guy called Dan Trailfoot, and we care about them. But anyway, it involves us going back and looking in different series. And I do go, oh, I forgot that series. They're brilliant, and I forget someone. And there's lots of moments as I've. Yeah, understandably forgotten. So no, I don't.
Do you feel that the form? I suspect I know the answer here, right? But do you feel that the format has a shelf life, or are you again? Because you said you're very optimistic. Are you quietly optimistic that it can just, you know, keep going until you run out of ideas?
Well, I don't think it has a shelf life. I think other things too. I think I do, and there's a chance at some point. Greg and I will want to do different things. There's only so many different things I can do whilst doing it. I can just about fit the one section in and a few other bits and bobs, but not a lot else because it does take up nearly all my time. So without sort of saying I'm leaving, there will be a point when I want to see my children a little bit more or my wife or travel the world more and that sort of thing. And Greg and I have always said when the time's right, you know, we don't want to drive it into the ground and we don't want people to be sick of it. But at the moment, we're loving doing it. So there's no sign of it ending. But as soon as it's not fun anymore, we'll stop.
Yeah. And Channel 4 stopped. Was it the thing that Greg said in one of the first Channel 4 series, you know, a big truckload of money in the back door? I think he said that, didn't he?
Something like that. Well, yeah. I mean, they definitely had more money than Dave. But Dave were absolutely brilliantly supportive. And Channel 4, you know, it's well documented that terrestrial telly is not in the place it was. So there's no guarantees of that either, of it being funded forever. So who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows? I mean, but there's plenty of comics, there's plenty of ideas. And I'd love it if Junior carried on forever because we're not going to run out of children. So I think. So yeah, there's no sign yet, but at some point it will.
And we're getting close to wrapping up, but I do want to ask you, you know those little quips that Greg does in the show where, well, especially the past couple of seasons where he says something that you've said to him, right?
In confidence.
Yes. Do you know what he's going to say? Do you know any of that?
No, well, I definitely don't know till the day. Occasionally, we do a camera warm-up, which is where we just make sure the script's in place, and I glimpse it on the auto cue and go, oh, that's what he's saying. He's like, oh, my word. And occasionally, if there's something really off-colour, he will check with me. So, do you mind if I name-check your wife in this one? Or your neighbours.
Yeah, he pushes it though, doesn't he?
He does, but I think it's so clear that it's a joke. And I think it's clear that actually he doesn't really have all the power. You know, I really hope that people, occasionally children come up to me and say, he's so mean to you. But most rational people can see that it's a joke. And you couldn't say those things if you thought there was any truth.
Yeah.
I think if you thought that my marriage was actually unstable, you couldn't tease it. So it does come from a place of actual probably love, as a Greg and I would get on really well. So it comes from a place definitely of respect anyway. So yeah, it's fine. And it's funny.
Yeah. Awesome. Listen, I want to say thank you very much for a million things. One, for being so patient with me. And I know you
still were patient with me, Chris.
Yeah, that as well. But I, again, you could have just, like a lot of people have, you could have just ignored it.
Look, I don't think I've sent the elevator down for you.
No, not yet. Afraid. I'm waiting on it.
Yep. That's it. That brings us to the end of this episode of The Peer Project. I really hope that you enjoyed the chat with Alex as much as I did. Sitting down with the creator of one of my all-time favourite shows, Taskmaster, is an absolute honour and a conversation 2 years in the making. Special shout out to the Taskmaster Alex posting group as well. You guys have been amazing during this whole process. Alex shared some amazing insights into creativity, perseverance, and the twists and turns of his journey. It's conversations like these that remind me why I started doing the podcast in the first place, to connect, to inspire, and to share stories that resonate with everybody. If any of Alex's stories sparked something in you then, or if you have thoughts and reflections that you'd like to share, I'd love to hear from you. Reach out on social media or drop a comment on the website. Make sure and like, subscribe, and rate on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, I think it's called now. Like and subscribe on YouTube as well, because I'm trying to build that. And if you're enjoying the Peer Project and want to support us more, then please consider becoming an executive producer. Just head over to producers.thepeerproject.co.uk. And your monthly contribution, whether it's a fiver or eight, you know, 5 grand, 5 million. If you've got that money, why not? Yeah, it goes a long way in keeping us and helping us keep the lights on and the conversations flowing. Plus, you do get some nice perks like full uncut interviews, live watch-alongs as they happen, exclusive episodes, and the chance to choose topics for high performance. Right, don't forget to subscribe. And you'll never miss an episode. I'm on all major platforms. And you can also watch the video versions right here on YouTube. If you liked the episode, please consider leaving a review as well. It really helps us with the algorithm. And lastly, a massive thank you to you, the new listeners, the long-time supporters. Your encouragement, your engagement means the world to me. It's a labour of love, this podcast. And it's made all the more special by this lovely community that we'll build together. Alright, until this time, take care of yourselves, keep pushing forward. My name's Chris Duke, and this has been The Peer Project. See you soon.